We've all heard the phrase, doing good by doing well. That's a phrase commonly used to support the idea that by pursuing one's own prosperity, that will have a beneficial impact on the lives of others. That is, if I am successful financially, that will benefit the economy, thus benefiting the entire community. Well, today we'll welcome again another talk with Nicholas Johnson, retired from teaching law at the University of Iowa, and the author of numerous books, essays, articles, and blogs. He recently wrote an article in the Gazette called Doing Well by Addressing the Poor, maybe a little different take on the idea of community prosperity. Nicholas, thank you for joining us again.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Holly.
My understanding is we decided that you would just present your essay, and then we can follow up with some comments and questions.
To do this right, I decided that I need to talk about several related topics. Central to all of them is the challenge of how realistically, not ideally, but realistically, can the congressional and executive branches of our government be encouraged to meet the needs of our most disadvantaged neighbors? And talking about this requires that we give attention to three things. To begin, the wealth gap, and then the role of money in politics and governing, and then the competing ideologies that we live by in this country, including how we think about taxes. First, then, is the wealth gap, and that can be briefly taken care of. The top 1% of Americans have 32% of all the wealth, roughly a third of all the wealth. The bottom 50% have a little over 2%. So the top 1% have 32 times what equal distribution would have given them, and the bottom 50% have 1/25th of what they would have under equal distribution. Nobody's advocating equal distribution, but it gives the idea of what we're talking about, and it happens that the United States has the widest wealth gap of all the world's top economies. Now, that's an economic and a political reality, a fact, and we've got to live within that until we get that changed, which is, at a minimum, a subject for a different column and a different interview. Second, what's the impact on our politics? I've done some studies in the past of how much a senator would have to raise every day in order to run once every 6 years. Well, someone else has done even more thorough research and come up with the number that a typical U.S. senator in 2020 had to raise nearly $20,000 every day. And there were three senators that year who raised over $95,000 a day. House members need to raise $7,000 a day. So a half or more of the working day of a member of the House or Senate is spent on the phone calling for dollars. Now, very few of those calls are going to that 50% of Americans who control 2% of the nation's wealth. How can we ever get programs through Congress to help that bottom 50%? Very few of those calls being made by senators and members of Congress go to that bottom 50% of the people. As if that's not bad enough, now let's take a look at some of the ideology we're dealing with. During my days in Washington many years ago, I asked Senator Hubert Humphrey once, I said, what do you tell the newly elected senators when they arrive? And he said, well, I tell them they have to work 4 years for the Lord and then 2 years to get reelected. And then another 4 years for the Lord and another 2 years to get reelected. Well, of course, there's still some officials who would agree with that. They may be responding to Jesus' admonition in Matthew 25 that we provide the least of these with food and water and shelter and clothing and health care and even prison visits. And there may be some officials who have acquired similar values but have taken a different path to get there. But the reality is that there are not 50 U.S. senators, let alone 60, who are sufficiently motivated by their religion or sense of decency or humanity to turn those helpful bills into law. And nor is there a majority among their most generous contributors who are asking them to do so. In fact, I think today Jesus might have a tough time getting his phone calls returned. So what ideologies tend to encourage support for business, corporations, and the wealthy, and discourage support for the bottom 50%? Well, I remember I was in Washington and Barry Goldwater was running for president. Somebody put out a Goldwater coloring book. And one page had this outline of Goldwater, and he was looking down on three very poor, very young children sitting on the curb of a city street. And he was saying to them, "Why don't you have the incentive to get up and inherit a chain of department stores like I did?" Well, it's hard enough to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, but it's an impossible task if you don't even have boots. There is a belief, an ideology, that says that if one is wealthy, it proves that they were worthy, that they earned it. If one is poor, it's their own fault, they say. Programs for the poor simply discourage the poor from working at low-wage jobs, they say. They believe, with those Michael Douglas's character, he played Gordon Gekko in the movie Wall Street, and that famous quote, "Greed, for lack of a better word, is good." Okay, so they argue that greed encourages more businesses and that creates more jobs. So the political reality we're dealing with is, in order to pass legislation to benefit the bottom 50%, the greed is good crowd has got to be convinced that, and it's contrary to their intuition and ideology, they have to be convinced that they too will benefit. Fortunately, there is a small group who see that the selfish interests for all, including billionaires, can come from what they call a rising tide that lifts all boats. They prosper doing well by doing good. They are aware that knee-jerk negative opposition without evaluating proposals, one might call a short-sighted greed, can lead to shooting oneself in the pocketbook. And they realize that starting public policy questions, the first ones we should begin with, should involve what kind of a country we want and the alternatives for getting there. And then worry about all the various ways of funding that, including actually the work of volunteers, who, if the value of their work was ever totaled up, would be greater than all the philanthropy combined. So starting with talk of tax cuts is starting off backing up. Here's another reality. Ours is an economy 70% of which is driven by consumer spending. Now, it may be obvious, but some don't seem to be aware that in order to have consumer spending, consumers need money. Cutting taxes for the wealthy, well, that may increase the sales of private planes and yachts, but it doesn't do as much for our gross domestic product, corporate profits, and billionaires' wealth, not to mention the bottom 50%, as giving consumers more money. Now, I think it was Ken Galbraith who addressed the futility of the advocates for trickle-down economics. He said it was best explained by the observation that if you feed the horse enough oats, some will pass through to the road for the sparrows. Now, let me give you three, four or so examples of what I'm talking about, where I think the business community and the greed is good crowd have really failed to see how they could profit. They could profit by being a little more thoughtful about the bottom 50% of Americans who control 2% of the total wealth. Iowa has a skilled workforce shortage. We've been hearing about this for a long time. We don't have enough skilled workers. Well, where do you get skilled workers? You get them from community colleges. Now, there are many high school graduates that can't afford the tuition. Iowa's businesses don't want to have to pay to train these folks, but they do need them. Well, now, if greed is good, why don't businesses force the legislature to provide free community college as we do K-12 education, and as many states and cities have done that define the benefits of free community college education. Now, if Iowa businesses would back free community college, they would get their skilled workers, and the skilled workers would enjoy better lives, but without their business having to pay for them. Second example, employee health care is a matter that creates both a lot of hassle as well as huge costs for businesses. A universal single-payer system would eliminate both the cost and the hassle for the business, while at the same time creating healthier and happier customers and workers. Now, shouldn't the greed is good crowd be able to see the economic advantages to them from doing this good? There's a self-described plutocrat named Nick Hanauer, and he makes a very persuasive case for the $15 an hour minimum wage along the lines of what I'm arguing here. And he cites the experience in Seattle where they went to $15 an hour and employers didn't lay off workers. Everybody profited. In fact, those who were working in restaurants could now afford to eat in restaurants. Everybody benefited, including plutocrats like Nick Hanauer, and there were 135 economists who signed on, supported a $15 minimum wage as well. Isn't this something that the greed is good crowd ought to take a look at? They could become wealthier by paying $15 than by paying the federal minimum wage of $7 and something. Another example are efforts to provide housing for the homeless. Number of cases where they've tried this apparently produced more savings in health care and other public expenditures, police and other stuff, than the cost of the housing. So it was cheaper to find housing and put them or build it and put the homeless in housing than to leave them out on the streets. And of course, it created much better lives for the formerly homeless. So if that's true, what possible arguments, except ideological ones, could be made for not doing it? Why anybody want to spend more keeping the homeless on the streets than it would cost us to put them in housing? Even if you don't care about the homeless, all you care about is greed. That's the greedy play as well. Public transportation. Now, billionaires and corporate executives aren't going to use it, but think of the benefits to their bottom lines, as well as to the bottom 50% of Americans. If a truly rider-focused, convenient, clean, rapid, and safe system brought them more customers and more on-time employees, why would they not support it? Well, these and others I could cite are sometimes very complicated issues requiring more research. I understand that. But all I'm recommending is that the research be done and decisions be made on the basis of that research, whatever the facts prove to be, rather than rejecting them on the basis of some ideology that doesn't help 50% of the Americans and doesn't help the plutocrats and the upper 1% either. I guess I'll close by saying if I were going to ask Iowa legislators anything, I'd borrow from Hubert Humphrey and I'd say, ladies and gentlemen, how about putting in at least 1 year for the Lord. Because if greed is good, suppressing the poor makes neither dollars nor cents.
Nicholas Johnson, thank you for presenting this analysis of your article that you recently wrote for the Gazette, Doing Well by Addressing the Poor. And you make a case for you can do well by doing good. In fact, if legislation is in place to support directly more of the community, then in fact that does support the local economy and on up to the state economy. So it seems like this is really a public policy issue. I'm also wondering, though you mentioned this $15 an hour minimum wage, which is being promoted for quite a long time now, and my question is $15 an hour, is that even enough at this time, especially with increasing inflation? I'm also wondering, what about the concept of universal basic income? That used to be kind of a pie-in-the-sky notion, but it's now become a mainstream point of discussion.
Well, I think there's a lot of support for that, and it may come as a surprise, but Milton Friedman and Richard Nixon both supported the idea of what Friedman once described to me as helicopter money, that you could do more good by just flying over a city and dropping dollar bills or $20 or $100 bills than you can through social programs. Just put the money in the hands of the consumers. There are several examples of where that's worked, and we had a presidential candidate, you may recall, one of these last times, who was advocating that. So, yeah, that makes sense. There was an employer who decided that it would be in his best interest, as well as his employees, to pay everybody who worked for him $75,000 a year. And his rationale was, for not giving them even more, The rationale was that he had access to some study that apparently showed that up to $75,000 a year, your happiness tended to improve. But after that, it didn't really make a lot of difference, that people earning $1 million a year aren't really that much happier than people earning $100,000 a year. And I said for years, maybe I should increase the number now, I suppose, because of inflation, but that I didn't see any reason in Iowa City at the time, this would have been maybe 30 years ago, for paying anybody more than $100,000 or $150,000 a year. Now, if you're in New York City or San Francisco, something like that, well, yeah, you're going to be paying that much in rent. But in Iowa City, Iowa, we need to pay people $1 million a year? I just didn't see the necessity of that. So what's the average income now of people who are working? I think it's around $50,000 a year, something like that, maybe more by now. $15 an hour for a 40-hour week would be $30,000 a year, and that's not up even to the average of what people need, and certainly not up to the $75,000 for optimum happiness. 15 is a start, and we can't even get that. And so my point is that short-sighted on the part of business. They at least ought to take a look at how much wealthier they might be if they did pay their workers more.
And you have made the point that when workers are making more, that money goes directly back into the local economy, goods and services, and supporting local businesses. I did have one other thought, and you're talking about general prosperity, and you talked about gross domestic product, but there are other ways of measuring well-being. I know the country of Bhutan has used something I believe called the General Progress Indicator rather than gross domestic product, because it measures things like health, education, and other statistics that are not just financial, as the gross domestic product does.
There's a survey done, I don't know if it's annually, but fairly regularly, of sort of a happiness index for countries in the world. And America does not score all that well, I might say. Denmark is usually one of the highest. That's in part because of not money, but things that money would buy. For example, if you have paid child care and college education. At one time, I remember when I was pitching the idea of a free community college, that there were universities around the world that would give free education to Americans as well as their own people or people from any other country, some of the top universities in the world where you get free tuition. You might have to pay for meals and room and board and all like that. And their rationale was that you would either stay in the country and be a benefit to the country, or if you went back to your home country, you would maintain your contacts and would do things that would be favorable to the economy of the country that gave you the free education. So the happiness index is tied to things like a good quality health care at no or radically reduced cost, and quality education, and good public transportation, and parks and trails, and a six-week guaranteed summer vacation, and family leave, and all that sort of thing. And so you say, well, that's not giving people money. No, it's not, but it's giving them what money has to buy in this country that other countries provide, because they know it's good for their economy to do it, and it certainly is good for their population, and they have happier, healthier people, and it works out to everybody's advantage, including the wealthiest that live there.
Thank you. We've been talking with Nicholas Johnson. He was a former Federal Communications Commissioner under the Johnston administration, and he served as U.S. Maritime Administrator and co-director of the Public Health Institute while in Washington, D.C. Recently retired from teaching law at the University of Iowa, he is the author of many books, essays, blogs, and other publications, and you can find out more about his work on two websites, from dctoiowa.blogspot.com. That's from dc2iowa.blogspot.com and nicholasjohnson.org. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with before we end today?
No, I think I've probably already told you more than I know, and that about covers it from my end. I thank you for the opportunity to talk with your audience and to try to boost KICI as a wonderful local media service.
Well, thank you, and thank you again for joining us.